This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Our word maven, Patricia Connor, writes, "You may kick or scream, too, when you find that many of your most cherished beliefs about English are as phony as a $3 bill. So what's right?" Our word maven says everybody has a vote. The rules are simply what educated speakers generally accept as right or wrong at a given time. This hour, we welcome Patricia O'Connor back to Talk of Iowa. As the theme of our discussion this hour, we'll use her book, Origins of the Specious, Myths and Misconceptions of the English Language. She co-wrote the book with her husband, Stuart Keller. Are there words or phrases that bug you, or you're just curious about how they were formed and how long they've been around? Our word maven, Patricia O'Connor, will help this hour. Talk of Iowa following news from Iowa Public Radio and NPR. This is Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese. Patricia O'Connor writes, "Perhaps the biggest myth of all is that English never changes, that it's immutable, like the multiplication tables or the boiling point of H2O. Change may be our language's greatest strength, but it's also the source of a lot of unnecessary angst." Our word maven is on the line live today on Talk of Iowa. Good morning, Patricia. And we'll see if she's there. Maybe not. I'll try it again. Patricia, are you there by any chance? Hello?
Hello.
Now we have you. Sorry about that. Just a little technical glitch to start the program as I was talking about the English language changing. I want to read one more line. You say, "You may kick or scream, too, when you find out that many of your most cherished beliefs about English are as phony as a $3 bill." Now, when I went through your book, Origins of the Specious, many of my greatest ideas were shot down.
Yeah, I know. It was disconcerting, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. But, you know, you mentioned that you, as an authority on the language, often learned that some of your cherished beliefs are just not the case when you look into the history of the language. So
right.
we're all on the same boat, kind of, right?
Right. I once mentioned when I was doing a radio broadcast, for example, someone called in to talk about the origin of the word Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I knew that it came from rendering of the pronunciation of the initials GP for general purpose vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what your idea was about Jeep?
Yeah.
That's what most people seem to think. Well, I got an email when I got home from a woman named Florence Eisner, whose husband had drawn the Popeye cartoon strip. He was one of the successors who had drawn it over the years. And she informed me that the name Jeep came from a cartoon character in the comic strip. And so I did some research on it, and she was right. The word Jeep originated in the Popeye cartoon strip in 1936, before the Army vehicle was named. And the true source was a character called Eugene the Jeep. Actually, this happened to me about 10 or 12 years ago, but since then, dictionaries have now come to accept this, and they've stopped saying that it comes from general-purpose vehicle and that it comes from a cartoon character, Eugene the Jeep.
That is really funny. You know, there's some words, we have an essay called Same Old, Same Old. The word synergy, which I always thought was a really modern word, what sounds more modern than we have synergy?
Right. Synergy is a pretty old word.
It goes back to 1660.
Yes. Yes. And it comes from the Greek. And it's been around for a long time. It comes from synergia. I'm sorry, it's adapted from Latin, meaning working together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was recorded in the 1600s. And it was just more or less revived later on, as happens with a lot of words. It was revived in the sense of two things working together. And it was revived in the 1960s. A man named H. Igor Ansoff, who wrote a book called Corporate Strategy, describes synergy as the 2 plus 2 equals 5 effect, a combined performance that's greater than the sum of its parts. And so it was revived for the modern age, but actually it was a 17th century word in English.
Yeah, and I want to read this one paragraph from chapter 10. It's short, but when I mention the date after the word, that's when the word was originated or first appeared. And you say, English simply won't stand still to a fuss budget, circa 1904, or a stick in the mud, 1733. It must seem like a child with attention deficit disorder, 1978. But English isn't sick, just in transit. Of course, we pay a price for all this restlessness. New words can leave us feeling discombobulated, 1830s. I always loved that word, discombobulated. We would like to hear our listeners' concerns this hour, questions, observations, and grievances, as Patricia O'Connor puts it in her book, Origins of the Speeches, one of her many books. She lives in Connecticut, a native of Iowa, and author of Woe Was I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English, and Words Fail Me. And we would love to hear from you this hour. 866-780-9100 is the toll-free line. We've been taking pledges, Patricia, the last week or so. So we had another. We've been bandying about another number for a long time, but we're going back to our normal call-in number for our talk shows, 1-866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This book, Origins of the Speeches, is just a huge amount of fun, just to breeze through, read an essay here, skip around, lots of entertaining explanations of the history of some of our favorite words, including one of my favorites that I haven't thought about lately, bloviate. Mm-hmm. People associate that with President Warren G. Harding, but you say that's it goes back for farther than that, further in history.
Yes. Again, that's another 19th century word that Harding seemed to like, and he was such a terrible writer and a terrible speaker that people turned the word against him and started saying that he was the bloviator.
I don't know if people use that word so much anymore, but it certainly would apply to some certain.
It came back into vogue about 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And then it sort of disappeared again. Now the next time it pops up, people will think it's been invented all over again.
I think of it in reference to certain evening cable TV political shows. But we have lots of calls coming in. We'll get to them in just a second once we get everybody locked in and to talk to Patricia O'Connor. And here is. In your essay called Hick Transit Gloria, you say a bunch
of... The Iowa angle, yes.
Well, I found the Iowa angle. I just gravitated to it for some reason. I just went right to page 157. You say a bunch of famous people come from my home state, Iowa. John Wayne, Herbert Hoover, Johnny Carson, Buffalo Bill, Ann Landers, and Abigail Van Buren. Then there's Charles Osborne, a pig farmer whose claim to fame was that he had the longest hiccup attack on record from 1922 until 1990, 68 years.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I can't believe he didn't just shoot himself somewhere along the way.
Really, I don't understand.
You got to hand it to him.
But then you this leads you into an explanation of how the spelling of the word hiccup has changed.
Yes, a lot of people think it should be spelled H-I-C-C-O-U-G-H, like hiccough. Mm-hmm. And they'll think that that is the literary spelling and that hiccup, spelled with a P, is the sort of garden variety, uninformed spelling. But in fact, hiccough, spelled with an O-U-G-H, is an error. It arose because people thought that... It was related to the word cough, but in fact, it's not related at all. Hiccup is what's known as an onomatopoeic spelling. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to sound like the like the thing itself, like sneeze is mm-hmm. something like that.
Okay. Well, let's...
And achoo.
Onomatopoeic. It's
yeah.
a great word, too, of course.
Right.
Let's go to our first caller, and this is Colin in the Quad Cities. And good morning, Colin.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air with Patricia O'Connor.
Fantastic. I've been watching children's shows with my youngsters, and they're told to say certain words, and I've been correcting the TV show, saying, no, don't say that, say this. The double T sound has disappeared from children's programming, such as kitten and mitten and button. It's kitten, mitten, and button. And I was wondering, where's my T's going? There's two of them. You should use at least one, please.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's an interesting question, and it's one that's been studied by phonologists, who are people who study the sounds of speech. And words like kitten, mitten, and button are not actually intended to be pronounced that way. Some people do pronounce both T's clearly. They say mitten and button and kitten. But in fact, the common pronunciation is to say the first T and then to sort of jump over the second one. In other words, kitten, kitten, kitten. That's and bottle. Well, no, actually, bottle isn't the same way. Button. Mitten. That's the normal pronunciation. One doesn't normally say button and mitten and kitten. So I guess I'm having to disagree with you there. Most people pronounce it almost as K-I-T apostrophe N. Know what I'm saying?
But they're not using the T's at all, not even one T.
Well, that's another pronunciation. If you're talking about kitten, kitten, or like in where I live on the East Coast now, a lot of people don't pronounce the double T in bottle. Whereas people in the Midwest would say bottle, they say bottle. It's a glottalized double T. They say bottle. That's a regionalism, and that's not the across-the-board kind of pronunciation. But no, to say mitten, that would not be normal. To skip the T's altogether, mitten, but we don't actually say both T's.
Well, Colin, I thank you for the question. That's been on my mind, too. I'm glad we had a chance to discuss that. We need to take a short break. Here on Talk of Iowa, we'll be back with Patricia O'Connor, our word maven, in a minute as Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. It's 10:20. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese with our word maven, Patricia O'Connor. Today we're trying to focus on one of her books, Origins of the Specious, Myths, Misconceptions of the English Language. And so we're asking for your questions, observations, and grievances about language. Here's an observation from an email from I don't know who it's from. But it's interesting. So just take my word for it. Years ago, my family and some friends started using the word apparently, combining apparently and evidently. We mainly said it jokingly, knowing it was incorrect, but over the years, it's become a common word for us. Sometimes I still get a chuckle from someone when using it. Recently, though, I heard a few other people using it. What are your thoughts on our new word, and do you think it could ever be adopted into the English dictionary, apparently? That's very clever.
Apparently. I think it would have to become a little more common than just among a group of friends. But if enough people start using a word, it does make it into the dictionary. I think possibly if President Bush had used it, it might have had a chance. I'm surprised that wasn't one of his. He used misunderestimating. And it's almost become part of the language. But no, I think it has to become pretty general to make it into the dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to, Dennis, I wanted to make one other comment about that last caller.
Yeah.
Phonology is not my specialty, and I probably didn't do a very good job of explaining what I was talking about. But when I look up the pronunciation of the word mitten in the American Heritage Dictionary, the pronunciation it gives is spelled M-I-T-N.
Mm.
Now, what that means basically is the vowel sound, that last E, isn't pronounced. We don't usually say mitten.
Yeah.
Mitten. We say mitten.
Mitten, yeah.
Right. So it's the last syllable is being abbreviated. And that happens with words like button,
yeah,
and kitten also.
But the worst thing would be to say mitten, or, you know, that's really
right,
bad. Yeah,
without
yeah.
any T sound at all.
Yeah, I've heard, right. I mean, I hear that once in a while.
That would be a non-standard pronunciation. But the standard pronunciation is that second vowel isn't pronounced. It's mitten. Mitten.
Well, let's go to a pet peeve. One more email before we get back to calls. Elsie in Cedar Rapids. I have a pet peeve. People who start any statement with the word so, as in, what have you been doing? So I was at the store and I heard it, you know.
You wouldn't believe how much mail I get about that.
Really?
About the so to introduce a response.
Yeah.
Where the so is inappropriate. It doesn't mean consequently.
Mm-hmm.
That has spread like crazy. And I don't know where it came from. I started getting mail about it about 5 years ago. People were hearing it a lot on NPR.
Yeah, she said that. She says she hears it on NPR all the time.
Right. Maybe this is one of those, it's sort of a relaxed,
yeah.
Ruminative habit of speech. I don't know, but it's obviously become a tick with a lot of people.
You know, another tick is politicians. Almost every politician is now saying, listen, to start their answer. Especially,
right. I find that very annoying.
Yeah.
It assumes that the person you're speaking to has to be told to listen.
Yeah. Okay.
Or won't attend to what you're saying.
Right.
I think that's a bit rude,
mm-hmm.
to start a statement with listen.
Well, listen, let's go to John next in Cedar. No, he's in Des Moines. Hello, John. You're on the program. You're in Des Moines.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. Interesting show. Of course, I've got 1,000 words I could talk about, but let's go to one that has bothered me recently. Somebody corrected it in a piece I wrote. I said, no, I did it the right way. I believe the correct expression going back to the late 18th century is jerry-rigged. That jerry-rigged, which is now what most people seem to prefer, jerry-rigged, is a bastardization of the notion of a rigged jury. But a jerry-rigged contraption is the correct expression.
That's a good question.
Yes, because jerry... The word Jerry, J-E-R-R-Y, has a long history of usage for something kind of slapped together on the spur of the moment, or something Jerry-built. That was the original phrase, Jerry-built. Jerry was a dialectical word meaning defective or slapped together, and it might come from the name Jerry. We don't know, but... it's Jerry built. See, it's the word. The original word was Jerry built, and Jerry rigged was thought to be from jury rig. So jury rig is the original form of that of the rig word, and Jerry built. As a result, people have gotten them all confused. But jury rig is the term. J-U-R-Y. And Jerry built. But as a result, we also say Jerry rigged.
Well, I think the Jerry is something to do with the Germans. I think it's a law, it's an old and more or less defamatory term for German, Jerry.
I thought that originated in World War I. I may be mistaken. calling the Germans Jerrys?
Well, and older than that. The first I found Jerry rigged.
Right.
I found that in the 18th century. One of the something like Tom Paine used that.
Hmm.
Well, John, we enjoyed that question. Why don't we need to move on, though. I do appreciate the call. Patricia, you have just an amazing knowledge of words. I am just blown away.
Right now, I'm trying to quickly look it up, which is it's always a challenge to do on the radio.
Well, you look it up while I just read a very quick comment from Erin. She says, please tell me that it's not okay to say the word nuclear. It should be, of course, nuclear. And that's a very common mistake.
Yeah, this will be a disappointment. That began as a mispronunciation, but it's now become so common that it's found in dictionaries.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, that's very disturbing.
Oh, actually, here's jury rig. Jury rig. 1788. To erect, construct, or arrange in a makeshift fashion. So that preceded jerry rig. So the two expressions were originally jury rig and jerry built. And they've become conflated over time so that now people say both jury rig and jerry rig.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It really is. Let's go next to Bill, who's calling from Brazil, Iowa. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the program.
Yes. First of all, don't you think that so is like an interjection? Seems to me it's becoming one of those throwaways for when you're not ready to speak.
Yeah, a filler. I think so, yeah. It's just a time-wasting, let me gather my thoughts a little bit word.
Right.
Right, you're right.
And actually your discussion, I had a question, but your discussion of hiccup reminded me, it might have even been a previous show, of a word. They were looking for words that we don't have, and one of them was for the sneeze that doesn't quite come.
Oh.
And it's one of the best I've ever heard. Somebody came up with sniff hanger.
That's
now,
good.
I'd like that one to make it.
Yeah,
but my question is, back when I was in Colorado 10 years ago, people would often say, that door needs fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering whether to be is not to be in due time. Is that becoming a standard, dropping the to be?
I don't know if I'd call it standard or not. It's a very well-known construction that you say there are several ways of doing this. Needs to be fixed, needs fixed, and needs fixing. Pardon me?
I like the two on the end. It's the middle one I have trouble with.
Yeah, needs fixed is quite common, though. It's just an ellipsis of the to be in there, needs fixed.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Thanks so much for the call from Brazil, Iowa. Bill called 866-780-9100 to take part in our Talk of Iowa program today with Patricia O'Connor, author of a number of books on the English language, including Origins of the Species. We're focusing on that today. Patricia will be back. You have 5 minutes to look up a few words if you want, and we'll be back in 5 minutes to continue Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Time is 10:36. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, along with our word maven, Patricia O'Connor. She lives in Connecticut. She is an Iowa native and has written some wonderful language books, including Origins of the Species, Myths and Misconceptions of the English Language. Before we go back to calls, Patricia, just a really funny essay, page 73, A Bun in the Oven. I'm sorry, I have to bring this up. A radio host interviewed me about my latest book, then asked whether I had anything new in the works. I have a bun in the oven, you replied. When I got home, I found a congratulatory email from a listener. Good luck with your pregnancy. Now,
right. I was referring to another kind of bun.
but the funny thing is, the use,
right, when you use a metaphor,
yeah.
You, you know, it, what I was using was already a metaphor. I was applying it to something else, and people were taking it more or less as the original meaning. I won't say literally, because that would mean having a piece of bread actually baking in your oven. But yeah, you have to watch out for metaphors. They can
right.
come back and haunt you.
Well, you say that the word oven has been used figuratively in English for the vagina or womb since the end of the 17th century,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of baking as a metaphor for gestation goes back to classical times.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah. By the way, I did want to mention, during the break, I did some looking up, and I found that the word Jerry and Jerry's to refer to Germans did originate with the British in 1915, so it was a World War I coinage.
Okay, good. Well, good. I'm glad we got that straightened out. Let's go back to calls. Ken is calling Talk of Iowa from Davenport. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. I had a question regarding the usage of kitty corner versus catty corner,
mm-hmm.
and understand the difference in the background a little bit, but I'm wondering about the geographic usage. I grew up in central Wisconsin, and we use kitty corner, and live in Davenport now, and you hear the term catty corner. And I've been collecting kind of loose data points through the years. In upstate New York, I've heard kitty corner, and in Washington State, I've heard the use of kitty corner. But I was curious where the
that phrase goes pretty far back into in English. British English, and I don't have that in front of me right now, but I do know that it comes from, it originally had nothing to do with kitties. It had to do with the French word for four, which is quatre, Q-U-A-T-R-E. And for, it may have been back in Middle English, which is before 1500, that the word for something that moved in a diagonal way, they described it as moving from corner to corner, and they imagined an area with four corners, and it moved from one to the other, and they said it moved quatre corner,
mm-hmm.
four corner. I know it doesn't make exact literal sense, but it actually came from quatre, the French word for four, cornered, and something that moved catter corner, and it was originally spelled with a Q, and later it was spelled catter, C-A-T-E-R, catter corner. Then it moved from one opposite corner to the other in a four-cornered configuration. So that's how we got the word. And it went from catter corner to catty corner, and then kitty corner developed, I suppose, on the assumption that the catty had to do with cats. So the original term was catty corner, and then it kitty corner developed. And I think both of them are pretty much standard across the United States now, kitty corner as well as catty corner.
Well, I'm a
kitty
man
myself.
So there were
no cats in the original phrase.
I'm a kitty man myself. I don't feel pretty strongly about it. Ken, anything else?
No, I was just curious if it was like a north-south thing, because I've heard it in Dubuque area. They seem to use kitty, but in Davenport, it's cat or corner.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 866-780-9100. Dennis is in Cedar Rapids. Good morning, Dennis.
Yes, appreciate your taking my call. Could your person speak to incorrect usage becoming standard usage? I'm a former proofreader. While going to UNI, I proofread for newspaper nights, and the spell check, I think, was invented to frustrate me. An example, at one time I thought it was he stood between two trees, or he stood among several trees, or used to have the term to home in on a target, H-O-M-E. Now you see it and hear it, H-O-N-E, hone in on a target, which to me, that doesn't make sense.
Right. Let me ask you first, which newspaper were you proofreading for? The Cedar Falls Record?
The Record.
The Record. Oh, yes. I remember the Record very well. I worked for the Waterloo Courier.
Okay. I worked nights. It only lasted about 2 or 3 years, and I was there from opening day, starting in about 1968. Anyway, getting back, I just had to correct a Gazette, Cedar Rapids Gazette sports writer yesterday, who wrote about this: the new basketball coach had a certain cash.
Oh,
instead of cachet.
Right.
I emailed him and I said sports writers should not try to use that word. But anyhow, can you speak to incorrect usage that becomes general usage? And I'll take it off the air. Thank you. I'm enjoying this.
Thank you.
Okay. The caller is quite right. What usually happens in the development of a living language, which English is that usage that's considered incorrect in one generation will change and become correct in another generation. But what I'd like to say about that is that it's really nothing to get that upset about. I, too, was a copy editor, and for many years these things bothered me a lot. When you take the broad view of the history of English and other languages that are still living, what happens is that the way we use words changes over time. I'll use an example. The word agenda. In the 19th century, agenda was a plural word. It meant items on a list. When people started using the word agenda as a singular for the list itself, of course, a lot of people were very upset because it was an incorrect usage. It's true, it was non-standard for a time. After the passage of some time, around the beginning of the 20th century, agenda used as a singular became correct. And that's how we use it today. And I could give you hundreds of examples of the same kind of thing happening in spelling, in usage, in pronunciation, in whether something is singular or plural, in how verb constructions work. What is incorrect in one century might be correct in the following century, or vice versa. What's incorrect a century, or what's correct a century ago, may be considered incorrect now. So these things change. And what happens is over a certain amount of time, there's a critical mass of usage that builds up, and if enough people use the word home in, or use hone in to mean home in, it becomes a correct usage, and it makes it into the dictionary. In fact, you'll find now, I think in the Merriam-Webster's 11th edition, which I have in front of me and I'm quickly looking, I'm betting that if I look up hone, it will say that you can use it to mean to zero in on something. Hone in, yes, to move toward or focus on an objective, as in home in. Here it is. It began use in 1965, an alteration of home in, and now it's correct to say hone in. Now, I would say that if I were editing a newspaper today and somebody gave me that phrase in written usage, I probably would still correct it because I would say to myself, who cares what Merriam-Webster thinks? I know that the old traditional usage, home in, probably still has the balance of opinion on its side, and I'd probably change it.
Go ahead.
But I would admit that, okay, hone in is now not incorrect.
Well, Jean from Coralville wants to chime in about homing in or honing in. Are you still confused about all of this, Jean?
No. I wanted to point. You just covered the ground. The difference between home in and hone in. The hone in seems to make no sense to me at all.
Right, because it means to sharpen.
It means to sharpen, of course. I wonder. I just tuned in. I wonder if back in the jury discussion, somebody mentioned jury rig,
as a pretty strictly nautical term. It has to do with raising a mast or a boom after it's been knocked down in a storm or whatever. Sailors find their way home with a jury rig, J-U-R-Y.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Eric,
I don't know.
Eric from Eric sent an email saying he went to Wikipedia, and jury rigging refers to makeshift repairs or temporary contrivances. It's a nautical term made with only the tools and materials that happen to be on hand. So
right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for taking my call, and I really hope. Would wish that we could eradicate that hone-in business, but as you say, it's just become too popular, I guess. Okay. The other thing is focus in on, which is equally as annoying, since focus means to lean in there and pay attention to the object, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you don't need the in.
We don't need the in. We don't need the in, and we certainly don't need the in on, which a lot of people are using. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. Let's go next. Now we got a funny noise on Patricia's line.
Oh, it's on my line?
I think so. We'll see. Well, it's gone away. Let's go to John in the Quad Cities. Hello, John. You're on Talk of Iowa.
Yeah, from the very beginning, when you started talking about this subject, the word, I don't know if I got this thing right or not, semiotics?
Mm-hmm.
Is that... This entire, well, I understood it as to mean the science of signs, S-I-G-N-S. Am I even close to being right on that?
I think so, but let me look at the,
okay.
I'm looking it up here.
I know it comes from
semiotics. It means observant of signs, to interpret signs, a general philosophical theory of signs and symbols.
All right. Are we talking about the same thing here?
No.
Oh.
No,
okay.
We're not talking about semiotics.
Say what?
We're not talking about semiotics.
Oh. All right. What exactly is semiotics? I guess that's my major question.
Well, according to the dictionary, it's the study of signs and symbols.
Well, I wonder, are signs and symbols, is a sign considered to be a word?
I wouldn't think a
That's
sign...
That's where I'm coming from.
I don't think so.
Oh.
I would argue that it's not.
Oh. Do you know what more it is?
What more a
more,
word
more,
is?
More specifically, when they say signs and symbols, exactly what's your guess as to what does that mean?
I'm not sure I know what your question is.
It's one of those, you know, it's one of those academic words that always scared me. I don't know why.
Yeah,
just,
and
you
anyway,
bring it up
this isn't
and...
a discussion of semiotics.
Words
are not signs or symbols.
Oh, that's what I was kind of wondering. Is a sign considered to be a word?
I wouldn't think so, no.
Or can it be?
This well, I suppose if it says stop and it's on a hexagonal.
Okay.
Board, it could be a sign.
All right, I've been wondering about this entire subject for a while, and I thought this subject pertained to that subject.
Well, no.
We got it clarified for you, John, I think. Thanks so much for the call. One line open, 866-780-9100. Our email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, to connect with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of many books on the subject of the English language. Let's see. Next in line is Greg in Cedar Rapids. Greg, you're on Talk of Iowa. Good morning.
How are you people today?
We're great. How are you?
Great. Beautiful day.
It is.
To me, it just seems like the greatest language is the language of love that's initiated and guided by the Holy Spirit. And when, no matter how different people's languages are, if they keep trying to communicate, but there almost seems to be an arrogance in the mechanics, and it just seems like people become too critical using the mechanics when they can have this beautiful relationship trying to communicate in love no matter what.
Well,
I think I can respond to that. I've heard this argument before, that you don't worry about the mechanics because the idea is to communicate. But the whole purpose of mechanics is so that you're communicating correctly. You're communicating the right thing. And I think if your mechanics aren't right, you often get miscommunication.
Well, that's certainly a good point. Let's move on next to another caller from Cedar Rapids. Here's George with us this morning. Hi, George.
Hi. I have a particular pet peeve with a phrase that many, 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 many people use, and I think it's incorrect. This phrase is at this point in time, and I figure that either one would work as well, this point, at this point, or at this time. Is this...
And the thing is, the phrase at this point in time isn't incorrect. There's nothing grammatically incorrect about it. It's just overinflated. It's redundant.
Yeah, there's a word for that.
Right, redundant. You don't
redundant,
need all that. Right.
Okay.
You don't need all of that.
Okay.
That started
right.
to be used.
You don't need to say plan in advance, for example.
Right.
If you do something in advance, it's planned. If you plan it, it's done in advance. So plan in advance is redundant. There are a lot of redundancies like that. Now, you can make an argument for what's called emphatic redundancies that help underscore your point. But a lot of times, the redundancy is just empty.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
George,
Thank
thanks
you.
So much for the call. Yeah, I was thinking at this point in time, I have this figured out. It started in about 1973, and I thought it would maybe last for a year. And all these years later, you're still hearing it. I don't get it. It's just amazing. We want to go next to Dave in Fairfield. Dave, you're on Talk of Iowa with Patricia O'Connor.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
If you have to take the word laughter and you put an S in front of it, you get slaughter. Is there any similarity in the origins between those words?
No. Nope, there isn't. I often get asked questions about words with GH in the spellings, and they're very interesting etymologically because they have an interesting history in English. Words that have GH in the middle, like daughter and laughter and slaughter, people will say, why don't daughter and laughter rhyme? Well, the fact is that at one point they did, because back in Old English and Middle English, these words were sometimes pronounced so that they rhyme. Daughter actually had three different pronunciations at one time. It could be pronounced dafter, doctor, or daughter. Now, words that have GH that come down to us from Middle English generally went into one of two directions. Some of them, the GH was pronounced as F, as in laughter, and in enough, and cough. And in some of those words, it became silent, as in daughter or ought. So that's why we have some words with GH that are pronounced as F, and some of them are silent, and they aren't related, except in that they come from these old Germanic roots that had at one time they were pronounced.
Interesting. Thanks very much.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for calling, Dave. Let's go to Olwine next. Alice is calling in to talk of Iowa. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I have a question about a word I think I hear mispronounced a lot. And is it library or is it library?
Mm-hmm. Another example is February. I get a lot of questions about that. The R spelling in English, R before another R. Say you have a syllable with an R before another syllable with an R. This occurs with library. It occurs with February. Those first R's tend to get elided in English pronunciation. That means they just get skipped over. We now know that the pronunciation February, without that first R pronounced, is the most common pronunciation of the word in English. Now, it's not true of library, for whatever reason. A lot of people say library, but not most people. But at any rate, it's an extremely common pronunciation, only because it's a little bit unusual in English to have R's in two adjoining syllables.
Alice, thanks. Right. Thanks. We want to try to get one more call in, if we could. A quick call from Jared at East Moline. Hello, Jared.
Hello.
You can make it fast here.
Okay. Simple one, actually. People trying to add syllables to words to make them sound more official or, in general, smarter when they add, take aluminum and pronounce it as aluminium or things along that nature.
Well, aluminium probably isn't the best example.
That's British.
The British pronunciation, and it's actually correct over there. We do tend to add syllables to things like orientate, preventative, when we don't need to. So I always think the simplest pronunciation is the best. That doesn't apply to aluminium, though.
Right. Patricia, we're out of time. Thanks so very much. It's been just a lot of fun. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Yeah, take care. Patricia O'Connor, author of Origins of the Specious, Myths and Misconceptions of the English Language, also Woe Was I, and a number of other books. That's Talk of Iowa for today. Our assistant on the program was Christoph Mai. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dennis Reese. Thanks for listening.